Srila Madhvacharya, I try to concentrate the majority of the discussion around his activities, his contribution in Krishna consciousness. So what I'll do is I'll read a little, and while I'm in between the reading, I'll do a little commenting. First of all, we should mention that there are four authorized Vaishnava sampradayas. And it is explained that devotional service in this age of Kali is found only within those four Vaishnava sampradayas, and that is the Brahma, Gaudiya, Madhva sampradaya in which we are partaking. It comes from Lord Brahma. It was given great contribution and great boost by Srila Madhvacharya, whose disappearance today is today. It is diverted or directed to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so it's Gaudiya, and then it is our line coming from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to the six Goswamis, from the six Goswamis ultimately Srinivasacharya, Krishna, Chakravarti Thakur, Baladev, Vidyapi, Bhushan, all the way down to Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhakti Vedanti Swami Prabhupada, and by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, we are here in this ISKCON movement, coming directly from the line of Lord Brahma, in which Madhvacharya is a very important part of that contribution. Also, there is the Rudra Sampradaya, coming from Lord Shiva. There is the Sri Sampradaya coming from Lakshmi, which we will speak about tomorrow in glorification by the founder of the Sri Sampradaya. It's Ramanuja Acharya, one of the greatest of all Acharyas in the history of the devotional service. And of course, there is the Nimbarka Sampradaya, the four Kumaras. So these four Sampradayas are the basic philosophical principles of devotional service within the world. Srila Prabhupada said, outside of these sampradayas, there's no real bhakti that is being given. Because all these are authorized by the fact that they have the disciplic successions coming back from their founders. So I'll read a little bit about Madhvacharya. First, I should mention that Madhvacharya is born of the wind god Vayu. He's not an ordinary personality. His birth is quite auspicious and quite celestial, and he was known for his opulence of strength. He was a very, very powerful personality. He exhibited his power in devotional service. Krishna says, I am that strength of the strong which is devoid of passion. You see people who have strength, they use it in a passionate way in order to achieve selfish and sense gratificatory ends. But strength, when it's used in Krishna consciousness, devotional service, can perform very wonderful activities, and we'll hear from some of these activities. So I'll read a little bit, and then we'll comment in between. According to Sri Kumara, inscriptions of Narahari Tirtha, his direct disciple, Sri Ramadvacharya, was born between 1238 and lived for 79 years until 1317 AD. This is confirmed in Anu Madhva Charita. According to the authorized biographies compiled by his disciples shortly after his passing away, Sri Padmadva was born in the village of Tulanada, which is located about 8 miles to the southeast of the city of Udupi in Karnataka. He came from a family of Shivali Brahmanas and was the son of Madhya Geha Bhatta. Now here we hear from Srila Prabhupada. In his Chaitanya Charitamrita commentary, Sripad Bhaktivedanta Swami comments as follows. In his childhood, Madhvacharya is born as Vasudev, and there's some very wonderful stories surrounding him. It is also said that his father piled up many debts, and Madhvacharya converted tamarind seeds into actual coins to pay them off. You can go to that place of his birth, and you can see that same tamarind tree is still there. And there's still tamarind seeds there. So the story was that his father had a large debt. And due to that debt, his father was in great anxiety. His mind was quite disturbed. So he said, Father, what is wrong? And his father explained. So he went to the very back of the yard in the house, and there was a tamarind tree. And he collected all these tamarind seeds. And he said, Here, Father, use this to pay off the debt. And immediately, all the seeds turned into gold coins. This was the power of Madhvacharya. One of my god brothers said he went there, he picked up the tamarind seeds, and they still remained as tamarind seeds. So, not everybody can do that. So if you're looking for gold, don't go there. So this was his transcendental power. He did it in order to save his father. When he was 5 years old, he was offered a sacred thread. A demon named Manima lived near his abode in the form of a snake. And at the age of 5, Madhvacharya killed that snake with the toe of his left foot. Just by his toe, he killed this very... It wasn't only a snake. It was a demon who had taken the form of a snake and was harassing many people. In fact, you go there today, and there is the place of the footprints of Madhvacharya, where he killed the snake. And there is some lines in the rock. It says that that snake was so powerful that when he would go across the rock, the poison from that snake would create impressions within the rock. Such a powerful snake. His poison was carving crevices right in the rock. But Madhvacharya, at a very young age, simply with his big toe of his left foot, he crushed the snake. When his mother was very disturbed, he would appear before her in one jump. And so that sometimes he was out playing with his friends and his mother would be in anxiety, he would know. So immediately he would just jump and he would land right in front of his mother and say, "Mother, how can I help you?" Sometimes it said he would jump for at least 1 kilometer. That's a pretty far jump. He was the son of the wind god Vayu, and we know that out of all the demigods, the most powerful demigod is Vayu. Because there's no greater power within the creation than the wind. And the power of the wind can simply destroy the entire creation. It can blow down buildings and just uproot everything. You see, sometimes we hear about hurricanes, Hurricane Floyd, Hurricane Dennis, so many hurricanes, Hurricane Gertrude. And they come with winds of 90 miles, 110 miles an hour. Hurricane Floyd was 125 miles an hour. And everything is destroyed. Houses are ripped down, trees are uprooted. And that's a small portion of the power of the wind. Small portion. The wind is very powerful. It's explained that the scientists, if they could harness the power of the wind, then all the energy problems in the world would be solved. The wind is so powerful. When he was a great scholar, even in his childhood, and although his father did not agree, he accepted sannyas at the age of 12. He was very young when he accepted sannyas. It is explained that he left his home and went to the home of his guru, who was known as Achyuta Preksha. And he was living there and studying under his spiritual master and receiving instructions. So his parents were very disturbed. And so they came to him and said, "Please come home, your only son." He said he didn't want to come home, but his guru asked him. So he went home. And then after some time, he left again and went back to the ashram of his spiritual master. And his father and his mother, they came after him again. His father was pleading, "Please come back, come back. You are our only son." He said, "I will come home, but you should have another child. And I will stay home as long as that child is born. And when that child is born, then I can leave." So the father agreed, because this was the only way he could get his son to come back. So they went home, and the parents... There was another child, another boy. So he said, "Okay, now you have an heir to the family, so I will go." And they said, "No." But he went anyway. And his father came after him. And his father was begging him, pleading him, crying, "Please come home." In fact, he got so emotionally caught up wanting his son to come back. You know how parents are sometimes. They become so disturbed when their parents... You can do anything. You can be a, you know... You can be a criminal, but if you become a Hare Krishna, that's worse. Right? You can do anything. Have fun. Eat, drink, be merry, get a good job, have fun, enjoy life, but don't become a Hare Krishna. You can take anything you do, but not that. Right? Becoming a Hare Krishna is dangerous. So
So his father was crying. So his father got down on his knees and he's begging him. And then little Vasudev, he said to him, "Ha-ha, this proves I am a sannyasi. Because one is supposed to offer respects to the father, but the father is supposed to respect the sannyasi." So a father never offers respects to his son by bowing down. That is the Vedic culture. But when he bowed down to his son, pleading with him, he said, "This is proof that I am a sannyasi. So you have given me your permission by your activities." So he left. And he took sannyas. The story of Sankaracharya, very similar. His mother knows. He said, "Mother, please, let me take sannyas." He wasn't living with his father. He was living with his mother. And he was a young boy. He was about 7 or 8 years old. His mother wouldn't let him take sannyas, because you have to have permission to get to take sannyas from your parents. That was the culture, the custom. So she would not give permission. So one day he was swimming in this lake and was this crocodile there. So the crocodile grabbed the hold of little Sankaracharya, and he was like, he said, "Mother, I'm dying. Please give me the permission to take sannyas before I die." She said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, Haribo." The crocodile just swam away. He said, "Thank you very much." Took sannyas. Crocodile was Krishna's special arrangement. So you see, especially in Indian families, the culture is very tight. The family structure is very close. And so to take, even you see the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mother was also very disturbed. So it's like that. So many times these personalities would use great endeavors and great tricks in order to get permission from their parents in order to follow their goal in life. When he was only 12 years old, Madhavacharya left home and accepted the renounced order of life under the guidance of Achyuta Preksha, his sannyas guru. Madhava's sannyas name was Purna Pragya Tirtha. His deep study of the scriptures was unparalleled and had convinced him of the uselessness of the Dvaita interpretation of Vedanta. He was inspired to revive the original and pure interpretation of Vedanta, which promotes personal theism. He was to do this on the basis of profound and innovative interpretations of the scriptures, for which he was to become famous. This interpretation is known as Dvaita Dvaitavada, or pure dualism. Now try to understand that this historical period of time when Madhavacharya appeared was a time when Sankaracharya's philosophy of monism was very, very much entrenched in many, many places of India. Sankaracharya was at the height of his success in preaching monism and Mayavadi impersonalist philosophy. This is when Madhavacharya appeared. So he was a force to reverse that trend within the culture. After his initiation, Purna Pragya spent some time in the ashram of Achyuta Preksha, where he carefully studied the Vedanta commentaries of different acharyas, beginning with the Istasiddhi of Vimuktaman. But soon, Purna Pragya's expertise in scriptural argument and determination to establish personal theism as the conclusion of Vedanta grew to the point where he could defeat Achyuta Preksha in argument. So he was able to defeat his own guru in argument. He was able to take the Vedanta scriptures and understand deeper and deeper meanings which had never been uncovered before. And he was presenting these meanings. Recognizing Purna Pragya's superior scholarship, Achyuta Preksha made him head of the ashram. Purna Pragya was also awarded the title Ananda Tirtha, by which he was often referred to in various scriptural literatures. After he became the temple authority in the ashram of Achyuta Preksha, Purna Pragya began training disciples, preaching his interpretation of Vedanta and defeating many scholars from different schools of philosophy, including Buddhists, Jains, Advaitins, and various impersonalists, agnostics, logicians, and practitioners of materialistic religion. His success in defeating all opposing scholars inspired him to tour South India in an attempt to preach the philosophy of personal theism and devotion to Vishnu far and wide. At this time, he had completely formulated all the details of his philosophical system, but had not yet committed his system to writing. His tour of South India was quite extensive. It took him from Udupi to the southernmost tip of India, Kanyakumari, and from there to Rameshwaram, Sri Rangam, and many other important holy places of pilgrimage. Wherever he went, he debated prominent scholars of the impersonal school, smashing their interpretations of Vedanta with his brilliant advocacy of dualistic theism. He his complete criticism of Sankaracharya's impersonal Vedanta met with stiff opposition, but no one could overcome him in scriptural argument or logical debate. It is said that when Madhva was at Kanyakumari, he was challenged by the greatest impersonalist scholar of the Sankaracharya to write his own commentary on Vedanta. If he disagreed with the teachings of the master refers to Sankaracharya at that time. At that time, it was said that Madhva promised to write his own Vedanta commentary, fully elaborating the proper conclusions of personal theism. At Sri Rangam, he also expressed a certain degree of dissatisfaction with the conclusions of Ramanuja's Vishishtadvaitavad, and that he felt it did not go far enough to refute the dangerous speculative philosophy of Sankaracharya. This further added to the young Madhva's firm determination to someday compose his own commentary, incorporating his own unique interpretation. So he was a revolutionary in his philosophical teachings. He took the scriptures deeper and deeper into the mood of personalism, showing the defects in the previous philosophies and ideas. After completing his South India tour, Madhva decided to tour North India as well. With his resolve to complete his own Vedanta commentary growing day by day, he began to work very eagerly. But Madhva wanted to have the blessings of the author of Vedanta, Vyasadeva himself, before beginning such an ambitious project. He set out for North India in the Himalayas, then, in order to achieve the benedictions of Vyasadeva, for it was said that Vyas, being mortal, still resides in the ashram of Badrinath, although he never made himself visible to mortal eyes. So this is 2 points here. One is that when one wants to embark on a spiritual project, especially a literary spiritual project, one should get the blessings and the approval of the Vaishnavas, especially the senior Vaishnavas. When one gets blessings and one gets approval in our attempts to spread Krishna consciousness, and then one is guaranteed of success. This is the fact. This is an etiquette that seems to be missing in our society. We try to do something, and we just try to do it. But it's always the etiquette to go to the senior devotees and ask for their blessings and approval. Because in that way, you're guaranteed success. I've had personal experience myself in attempting to do things that I felt were difficult tasks, as far as preaching to very large groups and trying to present some ideas. And then I always thought in my mind, Krishna was telling me, get the blessings, go to those devotees who are senior and ask for their, and you'll find that it's miraculous. When you get the blessings of the previous devotees, acharyas, or even the devotees in general, you have made a wonderful step in the right direction towards success. The tendency in our society is that we neglected this principle of etiquette, but it's very, very important in achieving success in anything we do. So, of course, Madhvacharya did that. He went to Vyasadeva to show Vyasadeva his commentary that he had written on Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Here it also mentions that Srila Vyasadeva is still living in Badrik Ashram. Of course, it's Adi Badri. There is Badri, Badrinath, and then there's Adi Badri. Adi Badri is the highest tip. And it is explained that he is still personally present there, even to this very day. But he is not visible on the gross level. He is there, doing his puja, his writings, his service to the Lord, even today. After a long journey by foot, Srimad Bhagavan finally arrived at Anantamath at Badrinath. There he remained for 7 weeks, absorbed in fasting, prayer, and devotional meditation. Inspired from within, he hiked further up to the Himalayas, to Badrik Ashram, in Upper Badri, where Vyasadeva has his hermitage. There he met Vyasadeva and explained his commentary on Bhagavad Gita to Vyas himself, who approved. When he met Vyas, he was given a Shaligram Shila, which is known as Astamurti. After discussing the scriptures with Vyasadeva, Shripad Madhvacharya's understanding of the inner meaning became even more profound. He remained at Badrikashra for some months until he finished composing his commentary on Bhagavad Gita, whereupon he returned to Anantamat. At that time, Madhva's companion, Satyatirtha, wrote down the entire commentary. At this time, Madhva also wrote his commentary on Vedanta. Bidding farewell, it's explained that when he went to visit Vyasadeva in the Himalaya Mountains, it's not an easy journey. Nowadays, if you want to go, they have a bus. You can get on the bus, and it takes a long time. Does anyone know? It takes many days to get there if you want to go to Badrinath. But in the summer months, beginning from May through, I believe, you know, fall, you can take a bus and go up, and it takes many days. But there was no buses in those days. So he walked, and he climbed. And many of his disciples wanted to come with him, to explain. But they couldn't keep up with him. He was jumping over mountains, practically. And he was moving very fast. And as hard as they tried, they had to give up. So he finally reached Badrinath by himself. After a while, he left. He began a long journey home. On the way, he met again and with and defeated many scholars of various philosophical schools. He traveled through Bihar, Bengal, Orissa, and Andhra Desh. The Madhva Vijaya describes how, when Madhva reached Ganjava on the banks of the river Godavari, he met two prominent scholars who were well versed in all the important scriptures, Sobhanani Bhatt and Swami Shastri. After converting them to his school, these scholars became renowned as important followers of Sripad Madhvacharya. They were formerly members of the impersonalist school. They became known as Padmanabh Tirtha and Narahari Tirtha, and are regarded as the principal acharyas of the Madhva school after Madhvacharya himself. Narahari Tirtha is famous in his commentaries on Madhva's Gita Bhasya and Karma Nirnaya. He was the prime minister of Kalinga between 1271 and 1293. Padmanabh Tirtha wrote commentaries on many of Madhva's works, including Madhva's Brahma Sutra Bhashya, his Anuvyakhyana, and his Dasa Prakarnas. He was the first commentary on many of the major works of Madhvacharya. After converting Sobhana Bhatt and Swami Shastri, Sripad Madhvacharya journeyed through Andhra Pradesh, Maharashtra and Karnataka, arriving at last at Udupi. Upon his return to Udupi from North India, Madhva confronted Achyuta Preksh, who had refused to accept his ideas previously. Now the roles were reversed. The guru became disciple, and disciple became guru. Madhva converted Achyuta Preksh from Sankar's Vedanta to the cause of Vaishnavism and accepted him as a follower. As a result of Madhva's success in defeating opposing scholars and gurus, his reputation spread, and enthusiasm grew for his new system of Vedanta philosophy. As his commentaries on Bhagavad Gita and Vedanta gained wider and wider acceptance, followers and new converts began to join his camp from all over India. Attracted by his charismatic personality, invincible logic and spiritual knowledge, and his inspired faith. While he stayed at Udupi, it was Madhva's regular habit to bathe in the ocean. One day, he was sitting on the beach absorbed in contemplation upon Krishna. At that time, he spotted a ship bound from Dwarka that was about to founder on a sandbar. He signaled the ship to safety and was able to safely approach the shore. The captain of the ship wanted to bestow some present upon Madhvacharya. And of course, it's only narrated slightly here, but the story is that Madhvacharya said, no, there's nothing I really want. It said that he waved his cloth like this, and he was able to signal the ship away from the danger and bring it to shore. The captain was so happy. He saved the life of the ship's captain and the entire crew. But the captain wanted to offer him something. He said, I am a sannyasi. Okay, what do I need? And he said, where are you coming from? He said, we are coming from Dwarka. He says, do you have any Gopi Chandan? He said, actually, yes. The captain from the ship, in order to keep the ship balanced, because on the sea, the winds are there, he had these two large blocks of Gopi Chandan, which was so heavy. They were like weights in the ship. He just took them in order to balance the ship. So he offered them to Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya was happy to get them. And as it's mentioned that he picked both of them up with his hands, and he was carrying them. He had the strength of like 30 men or more. He was so strong. And while he was carrying them, one of them broke open. And inside that, there was a deity of Balaram. He was on his way back to Udupi. And this deity of Balaram, he established a temple right there where the deity fell, where the deity broke open. And the other one he took back to Udupi. And inside that block of Gopi Chandan, there's a beautiful, beautiful deity of Gopal Krishna, Ladu Gopal, Krishna holding Ladu like this. I was just in India, and the devotees had just gone to Udupi for a yatra. And they came back, and they brought me some prasad and some pictures of Udupi Krishna. It's a beautiful deity. And the history of the deity is quite interesting, because when Krishna was living at Dwarka, all the queens at Dwarka didn't know Krishna's childhood Leela. And they was always fascinated, because Krishna was always in the mood of calling out and crying out from the residents of Vrindavan. So the queens were always wondering. Krishna's always thinking about Vrindavan. So they were wondering, what was it like when Krishna was in Vrindavan? So there was one personality who was living in Dwarka that was there, and that was Devaki, the mother of Krishna. No, it was Rohini. I think it was the mother of Balaram. She was there. And Rukmini, she said to Rohini, she said to her, you are fortunate. You are able to see Krishna's Bal Leela, his baby pastimes. We have been so deprived of that nectar. So please, can you tell us about this Leela? So Rohini did that, but what she did is she made a deity, and she formed this deity as to show the residents of Dwarka Krishna. And it was a beautiful deity of Krishna when he was just a little baby. You see that in all the altars. Like you see many altars, they have Krishna holding Ladu like this. They call him Ladu Gopal. Right? Sometimes he's got big Ladu, sometimes little Ladu. So this is the deity of Udupi. It's like that in that position. So what happened was, when Dwarka was devastated, that deity fell into the lake there. And the lake, that lake is filled with chandan. That's one of the places you get chandan in the world. Gopi chandan comes from Dwarka, a lot of it. And so over the years, that deity was covered over and over and over by this chandan. And so that deity was in the block of chandan that was taken by that merchant. And so when that ship came, Madhvacharya got that block of chandan. When the deity, when it broke open, there was that same deity that was worshipped by Rukmini in Dwarka and formed by the hands of Rohini. A very special deity. You could go and see that deity today. It's there in Udupi. So that was the deity he established. After installing the deity in Udupi, he revised this system of deity worship, establishing a strict regimen of ceremonial ritual and proper conduct among his followers, imposing, among other things, the rigorous observance of fasting on Ekadasi. Having achieved such great success at home, it was time for Madhva to once more travel afar. He began a second pilgrimage to North India, where he once again visited Bhadrikashram. The Madhva Vijaya, written by the son of one Madhva's disciples, describe how Madhva used his sharp wits, his knowledge, and many languages, such as Turkish and Persian, and his courage to overcome great obstacles in his preaching. While on a northern Indian tour, Madhva and his disciples arrived at a place in the province of Ganga Pradesh, where political tension between Hindus and Muslims prevented them from crossing the river. The Hindus were on one side of the river, and the Muslims on the other side. No one dared cross, and no boat was available. Madhva and his followers, without regard for the Muslim soldiers who guarded the crossing, swam across the river. The entire camp was placed under arrest. Madhva himself was taken before the Muslim king, Sultan Jalal ud-Din Khilji, who demanded an explanation. When Madhva was finally allowed to speak on his own behalf, he spoke in Persian, addressing the king at length on devotional theism. Seeing the intensity and saintly purity of Sripad Madhvacharya, the Sultan's heart was softened. So impressed was he with Madhva that he wanted to offer him land and money. When Madhva set the example of renunciation by humbly declining the Sultan's offer. Where wit would not help, Madhva would sometimes use his superhuman strength to save a situation. Once, his traveling companion and sannyas disciple Satyatirtha was attacked by a fierce Bengal tiger. Fearless, Madhva went to the rescue. After wrestling the tiger away from Satyatirtha, he sent it away with its tail between his legs, like a little puppy dog. Another time, while walking on pilgrimage through a dangerous part of India, they were attacked by these dacoits, murderous, dangerous dacoits with weapons. He just killed them all. No problem. It was like, you know, it was just like passing time. He was so strong. It explains that are coming to this part. Madhva was a multifaceted personality who lived a long and healthy life. He was a natural leader who believed in physical culture as well as intellectual, moral, and spiritual culture. So many of you who are into bodybuilding can take some condolences and some shelter of Madhvacharya. Consolation in Madhvacharya. He took part in many athletic activities such as wrestling, swimming, and mountain climbing, which served him well in the Himalayas. As he came from a family of Brahmanas that had descended from a warrior Brahmana, the incarnation of Godhead, Parasuram Ram, he was tall, strong, and robust. It was reputed that there was no limit to his bodily strength. The Madhva Vijaya records how a strongman named Kandajari, who said to have the strength of 30 men, once challenged Madhvacharya to a contest of strength. Madhvacharya, this is an interesting story, Madhvacharya placed the big toe of his foot firmly upon the ground and asked Kandajari, the famous strongman, to see if he could lift it. Straining with all his brawn again and again, the mighty Kandajari was unable to move the big toe of Madhvacharya. And I found out just recently from the devotees that they were telling me that this happened when Madhvacharya was about 70 years old. And he wasn't a young man at the time. He was quite old when this happens. And here's this big, powerful man who's got the strength of 30 men. He places his toe on the ground. He said, okay, move my toe. Couldn't even, with all his might he was trying, he couldn't even move his toe. Such a powerful personality. According to Trivikram Pandit, Madhvacharya was endowed with all 32 bodily symptoms of a great personality. He had a deep, sonorous, and melodic voice and was an expert singer. His recitation of the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam was regarded as being especially sweet. In this way, Madhva traveled extensively throughout the whole of India. He returned to South India having visited Badrinath, Delhi, Kurukshetra, Benares, and Goa. After this, his travels were mostly limited to those provinces of South India near Udupi. After Sankaracharya, who had also traveled extensively, he was the second important Vedantacharya to travel throughout India, and his broad preaching campaign had a lasting effect. Gradually, his following grew, as great personalities from all parts of India accepted him as guru. The Madhva Vijaya mentions that he had disciples from many lands, and his present-day followers are still include the speakers of 8 different languages: Tula, Kannada, Konkani, Marathi, Telugu, Southern Saustri, Bengali, and Hindi. After returning to Udavi, Madhava once again immersed himself in prolific literary activity. He wrote commentaries on the 10 major Upanishads. He wrote 10 major philosophical treatises, the Dasa Prakaranas, as well as what many consider his most important work, the Anyu Vyakhyana. He wrote a summary of Mahabharata called the Moksha Dharma, and he also commented on Srimad Bhagavatam. Madhvacharya's dedication to the Lord and his deep scholarship made him a feared and hated enemy of the followers of Sankaracharya, who had a vested interest in maintaining their position as the only bona fide Vedantists. It has been said, of all the plagues with which mankind is cursed, ecclesiastical tyranny is the worst. The tyranny of the Acharyas of the Sringari math founded by Sankaracharya led them to attack Sripad Madhva with every means at their disposal. They employed various means to harass the followers of Madhva. They tried to prove that Madhva did not come from any authorized disciplic succession. Finally, they challenged Madhva to a debate. The Sankarites chose as their champion pundit a highly learned scholar named Pundarik Puri, who was famed for his erudition and expertise in argument. In the debate with Madhva, he was humiliated. Well, in arguing with Madhva, Pundarik was like a schoolboy facing a professor. Aching for vengeance, the defeated pundit arranged for one of his cohorts, a sannyasi named Padmatirtha, to steal a priceless collection of ancient Sanskrit scriptures from the library of Sripad Madhvacharya. The books were later recovered with the help of King Jayasimha of Kumla. That's an interesting story too. What they did was, in debates those days, you came with your scriptures. You came with your books. If you were just there without any backing, authorization, and then you weren't taken very seriously. You weren't an authorized debater. So what happened was, in order to make him look bad, they challenged him another debate, and then they stole his books, so he couldn't have any books to back up. But Madhvacharya came without the books, and he quoted the books anyway. He was quoting all the scriptures and defeating them anyway. So he had all knowledge of all the scriptures, authorized knowledge like that. After Jayasinga Rai recovered the books of Madhvacharya, an audience was arranged between Jayasimha and Madhva. The meeting was to be followed by a debate between the king's own court pundit and Madhva. The pundit, Trivikram Pundit, a resident of Vishnu Mangala, was the foremost authority on impersonal Vedanta in the land of Kamala and an expert poet. They met in the temple of Kundil. At the end of the day's discourse, Trivikram Pandit had failed to defeat Madhava, but he refused to surrender. The debate was continued on the following day. The next day, Trivikram Pandit used all his learning, his wit, and his power of argument in an attempt to embarrass Madhava, but after exhausting himself, was again unable to defeat him. This went on for 15 days. When Trivikram Pandit, his intellect spent, his doubts destroyed, recognized Sripad Madhva as his guru. He surrendered to the lotus feet of Sripad Madhvacharya and accepted him as his disciple. Madhva ordered him to write a commentary on Vedanta. Trivikram Pandit's commentary is called Tattva Pradeep. His conversion was a turning point in Madhva's preaching mission. After his conversion, Trivikram Pandit's own brother and 7 other important scholars took sannyas from Madhva and became the first directors of the 8 Madhvite monasteries in Udupi. Trivikram Pandit's son, Narayanacharya, who later wrote the Madhva Vijaya. So here was really a height of his success after he defeated his most prominent of all impersonalists, Trivikram Pandit. He surrendered to him, and he brought with him some of his followers. And they established some of the monasteries and mosques that are very still prominent within the Madhvacharya
Sampradaya. I'll get into that part a little later because it's a very important part of their whole preaching mission. They have 8 prominent mats. And what happens, every 2 years, there's an election of a mat leader who's a sannyasi. And he stays at the mat for 2 years and he worships the deity for 2 years. And he's considered the head of that particular monastery or mat. And after 2 years, there's a changing of the leadership. This January, the devotees from Chaupati, they all went for that ceremony. And the ceremony begins at 1 a.m. in the morning. You get up something like 11 o'clock. The devotees were telling me they took rest at about 7. They got up about 11. And then they had a march through the town. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. This was just last month. And then they go to one of the main temples. They go to the main temple at Udupi. And there the leader of the Madhvacharya Sampradaya, whose name is Tejo, what's his name? Can't think of his name. Well, anyway, I'll think of it later. He was there, and then they have a ceremony for changing of the sannyasis. And the 8 sannyasis are there, and then there's a big ceremony. It starts at 1 a.m. in the morning. And you have to walk for a couple of kilometers through the streets. There's a procession. And at 1 a.m. in the morning, the streets are just packed with the hundreds and thousands of pilgrims coming from everywhere just for this particular ceremony. This year was a little bit of a difference, because, and I'll tell you one little story that happened. It explains that in the scriptures, according to I'm not exactly sure where, but it says that sannyasis are not supposed to cross the ocean. That was the tradition of India, that if a sannyasi crossed the ocean, it was considered that he was going for sense gratification, because the land of India was a land of dharma, barbarsha, the land of... But of course, Srila Prabhupada broke that tradition in order to preach Krishna consciousness in the world. But there are many places that keep that stricture very, very tight. So about a year and a half ago, I think it was 2 years, one of the Madhvacharya leaders of one of the mosques, he came to New Vrindavan. I was there. And he was speaking. He came with a little entourage of some followers. And he was one of the leaders of one of the 8 mosques from Madhvacharya's Sampradaya. So he was speaking, he was giving his lecture. And very sweet. All he was speaking was Krishna Leela. I found out. We went back when we were just in India, when they had the changing of the ceremony. Only 7 of the mosque leaders showed up. This one man who went to America wasn't allowed to come to the ceremony. And if he did come, all the other 7 sannyasis said they wouldn't come. They threatened not to come if he came. So he was somewhat ostracized for crossing the ocean. Very strict. You know, of course they have their sampradayas and they have their rules and they have their regulations. But of course we're different because we have a worldwide preaching mission. They also preach, but they preach in India. And of course, Madhvacharya Sampradaya and ISKCON is very close in many ways. There were many, many ISKCON devotees at that ceremony. Jagataka Maharaj was there. Who else? Of course, Raghunath Swami was there. Jayadwaita Maharaj was there. Veda Vyas Maharaj was there. Many sannyasis from our line, ISKCON, was there at this ceremony. It's a very beautiful ceremony every year, 2 years. You can go. It's in January, and every other year in the month of January. Right around Makara Sankranti, right after. So, and this is the way they worship. And of course they preach very strongly. Okay, in the final years of Madhva's life, he wrote commentaries on the scriptures, including the Naya Vivarana, the Karma Nirnaya, the Krishna Amrita Maharnava, and others. By this time, Madhvacharya was growing old,
He completed what he set out to do. He had preached his message far and wide, elaborated his philosophical system and numerous commentaries, and had many trained missionaries who could carry out his work with great energy. He had written original works of such a profound character that they will continue to influence devotional theism well into the 20th century. He had established the work of Krishna in Udupi and had given sannyas to expert scholars and veteran preachers such as Padmanabh Tirtha, Narahari Tirtha, and Madhava Tirtha, and Asogaya Tirtha, who would succeed him in promoting the philosophical ideals of pure dualistic theism. After he finished his commentary on Aitareya Upanishad, on the verge of his 80th birthday, Srimad Madhvacharya passed away from this world and entered the Vaikuntha planets on the ninth day of the full moon in the month of Magh, corresponding to January-February in the year 1317. That's today. The essential principles of Madhvacharya's teachings were where they run parallel to the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, have been summarized in 10 points by Baladeva Vidyabhushan in his Prameya Ratnavali. The 10 points are as follows. Sri Madhvacharya taught that 1. Krishna, who is known as Hari, is the Supreme Lord, the Absolute. 2. The Supreme Lord may be known through the Vedas. 3. The material world is real. 4. The jivas or souls are different from the Supreme Lord. 5. The jivas are by nature servants of the Supreme Lord. 6. There are two categories of jivas, liberated and illusioned. 7. Liberation means attaining the lotus feet of Krishna, that is, entering into an eternal relationship of service to the Supreme Lord. 8. Pure devotional service is the cause of this relationship. 9. The truth may be known through direct perception, inference, and Vedic authority. These very principles were taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In his Chaitanya Charitamrita commentary, Sripad Bhaktivedanta Swami comments, "For further information about Madhvacharya, one should read Madhva Vijaya by Narayan Acharya." So, these were the principles that Madhvacharya taught. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared to Madhvacharya while he was there. It was a special vision that Lord Chaitanya came and told him, "I will be coming in about 200 years. So, and I will take from you two principles, and I will incorporate it into my philosophy and teachings." And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took two principles from each of the four sampradayas and made that the foundation of his teachings, which was Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. The two principles he took from the Madhvacharya Sampradaya was the complete refutation of impersonal philosophy, and which Srila Prabhupada was very strong on, Nama Om Vishnu Bodhaya Krishna Vrstaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamne Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharya Nir Vishesha Shunyavadi Pastadya Desatara. He came to destroy Nir Vishesha Shunyavadi, the conception that Krishna is impersonal and the idea of voidism. Prabhupada adopted that as prana mantras, and that was one of the main teachings in the school of Madhvacharya. And the second principle was deity worship, the conception of worshipping the deity. So these two things, you read Prabhupada's teachings and his comments on deity worship, these are coming from the teachings of Madhvacharya. So you can see how we are so intimately connected with the teachings of the Madhva school like that. So these were the two principles. Complete, not just refutation, but complete refutation of all Mayavadi impersonalist philosophy and the concept of worshipping the Lord in the form of his deity. Now these come from Madhvacharya. Any comments or questions, contributions, anything else? Yes, Siddharth?
Isn't it still a practice amongst the followers of
Yes, at very young age, they give sannyasi, following in the footsteps of their founder, Acharya.
Like understand it's like a very imaginative correlation to astrology and other things, so I'll study the character of the boy.
I'm not familiar with the ceremony in detail, but it is given a greater celebration, auspiciousness. Yeah. And that's very important, you know. Take a child from that age and keep him, grow him up. If he has that tendency, then develop that tendency and let him become a good, great sannyasi. There's no shortage of anything in the world except religious principles. Religious principles are the only real shortage in the world. Srila Prabhupada said that. The only real shortage in this world is lack of Krishna consciousness or God consciousness. So, training and teaching our children at a very young age is a very, very essential part in building the world towards God consciousness. Those who have families, who have children, it becomes a very, very effective in raising a person God conscious when we do it from the very, very beginning. And the beginning is not from when they are born. The beginning is Garbhadhan Sanskara. Even before is born. The proper method of purification for begetting a child, according to the authorized means of the sanskaras. And that guarantees that already a good soul will take birth within that family, what follows the Garbhadhan Sanskara. Nowadays, people don't follow anything. They don't even know what sanskara is or purificatory method. That's why, when Prabhupada used to say, the society is simply animal society. And the sanskaras are the difference between human society and animal society. People who don't follow sanskaras, they're living animal life, basically. Any other comments or questions on Madhvacharya's contribution?
What was his sister from Alaska? Was it
Vashishta Dvaita? Dun. That's dualism. Dualistic philosophy. That there is a difference between the Lord and the living entities. There's a difference between the Lord and the material world. It's not all one. You see, Lord Chaitanya took that principle with Madhva formulated and brought it to this ultimate conclusion, Achinta Bheda Bheda Vatatva, that everything is simultaneously one and different. Madhvacharya, Visankaracharya emphasized the oneness. And Ramanujacharya, he came before Madhvacharya, and he took it a little bit away, but he didn't qualify it completely. This is called Vishishta Dvaita, and there's still some tinge. But then Madhvacharya made a complete break and made dualism without any emphasis of the oneness. And Lord Chaitanya took that principle and combined it and made it Achinta Bheda Bheda. One, that the absolute truth is understood in the principle of one and different. Simultaneously one and different, like that. It's a great philosophy. There's many works. There's one devotee, his name is Purushartha. Puru Sartha Maharaj, he's from somewhere in South America. He teaches these classes on the four sampradayas. You can learn. If you go to Mayapur, you can take classes and learn about the details of the four sampradayas. Puru Pusatraya, that's right. Pusatraya Maharaj. So, if you want to preach, It's important to learn these different distinctions. You can still preach without it, but sometimes you run against people who have knowledge of that, and then you get stuck. So, Sabde Parachara Nishnam Brahma Upasaya Srayam. And then one is the spiritual master is versed in all philosophical systems, and he can put forth arguments in opposing all systems of philosophy. And that is the quality of an acharya. Then. anybody know the story of Madhvacharya eating the bananas? There's a story about him when he ate all these bananas. There was, remember? Anybody know that story? Prabhu Bhakti Prabhu? Dima. He did this service by eating all these bananas one time. I forgot what it was. He did it to please some king, I think it was. Huh? I remember the story, huh? Okay, so today's a very special day. And as Prabhupada says here, for further information about Madhvacharya, one should read Madhva Vijaya by Narayanacharya. I don't know where that book is found, but that's where they go. And there's been some articles written in some different places about Madhvacharya's life, so you can read. Okay, anything else? Okay, so today is Sunday. Is it cleanup time?
Yes. So we do the general cleanup of the evening at this time, and we require some help in the kitchen. And the shop is set up. I'm usually not there in an hour.
Okay. Thank you very much for your kind attention. All glories to Srila Madhva Acharya. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
I worship Sri Pada Ramanuja, the incarnation of Ananta, who took birth in the month of Chaitra, April, May, under the sixth lunar mansion in the Tundira Desh, and who came upon this earth to establish the philosophy of Sri Vishnu. The four major schools, or sampradayas of Vaishnavism, are considered authorized by Vaishnavas everywhere: the Brahma, Sri, Rudra, and Kumara sampradayas. Now, Gaudiya Vaishnavas follow the cyclical line of Vishnu, worshipping originally with Brahma. Sri Pad Ramanujacharya is the founder acharya of the Sri Sampradaya, the school of Vaishnavism, where Vishnu worship descending from the eternal council of Vishnu known as Lakshmi Devi, or Sri. His commentaries on Vedanta rival those of Sankaracharya, especially in Tamil-speaking South India, where Sri Vaishnavism is prominent to this day. He propounded the Vedanta philosophy known as Vishishta Dvaitavada, or qualified monism. The most famous among his numerous writings are the commentary on Vedanta, Sri Vasya, his commentary on Bhagavad Gita, his Vedanta Sara, and Vedartha Samgraha. Many biographies of Ramanuj were compiled shortly after his passing, including the Sanskrit Papanartamritam of Anantacharya and various Tamil works. These authorized sources provide quite a detailed portrait of Ramanuja's life and teachings. Before we consider Ramanuja's importance in the development of Vaishnava philosophy and practice, however, we must first consider the South Indian Vaishnava traditions from which Ramanuja came and which influenced him. During the time, Ramanuja appeared approximately about 100 years or so before Madhvacharya. And these two acharyas pretty much swept clean the influence, not clean, but very much made a big dent in the influence of Sankaracharya. You have to realize that Sankaracharya made a big impression in India. And still today, the schools are very, very powerful everywhere. But Ramanuja came first. He was the first to challenge that. And then, of course, Sri Madhvacharya came after that and continued that. And he took it to a higher stage of devotion to Vishnu. But Ramanujacharya, you have to understand one thing, that he came at a very, very prominent time in Sankaracharya's stronghold. So he met a lot of opposition. A lot. In fact, his life was threatened many times when he had to escape. And many of his disciples were tortured and blinded and killed because of their preaching. So it was a very difficult time. So here there's a section which describes his guru. His guru was Nathmuni. And we'll skip that because there's limited time. His second guru, who also was just as prominent as his first, was Jamunacharya. And Jamunacharya, his life is very, very interesting. There's a large section of Jamunacharya here. There's 18 pages here, so. One of the things that was very interesting in the life of Ramanujacharya is that Jamunacharya and his preachings and teachings felt his mission to be incomplete at the time of his leaving this world. And at that time, when Jamunacharya was leaving the world, when he had already left the world, he was laying on his deathbed, you might say. And his disciples and Ramanuja were there. Of course, Ramanujacharya took Jamunacharya as his main guru. He was like a shishya guru, but Nathmuni was his main, his initiate guru. Just like even in our ISKCON movement, we have a spiritual master. We have an initiating spiritual master. But the tradition is that your initiating spiritual master does not have to be your prominent spiritual master. And the history of our simple succession shows that in many cases the shikshu guru, or the one who was giving relevant instructions, as opposed to the diksha guru, who also gave relevant instructions, of course, but in many cases was the prominent guru in the lives of many great souls. So here we find it also in the case of Ramanujacharya. In fact, we had three gurus: Nathmuni, Jamunacharya, and Kaustipurna. And Ramanujacharya was very, very strong in preaching. But before he left, he had some unfulfilled desires. Just like Srila Prabhupada, before he left, he had one strong unfulfilled desire: to establish Vaishnava Dharma within our movement and lay the foundations and development for that. He never did get to that point in his mission, although he tried. But he laid the foundation through his teachings and preachings. So when they were there at the, one might say, the lamentation of Jamunacharya, he was laying there, Ramanuja was there,
And Ramanuja noticed something that he never saw before. His spiritual master's hand was clenched in a fist. And he said to his disciples, or his godbrothers, and he said, I never seen Jamulacharya's hand clenched in a fist like that. Did he ever hold his hand like that? And they said, no, we have never also seen him like that. But then Jamulacharya understood something, that his spiritual master was trying to communicate something even while he had just left the world. So Ramanujacharya, being very much in tune with the instructions of his spiritual master, said, yes, there were three unfulfilled desires that Jamulacharya wanted. So Ramanuja decided to take those three things and make his life vision. And then he repeated them out loud. He said, first, to travel and preach everywhere and establish the teachings of devotion to Lord Vishnu based on the scriptures. And then Jamulacharya's clenched fist went, his hand moved, indicating, yes, that was the first reason. And then he said the second reason was to write a commentary on Vedanta Sutra, defeating Sankaracharya's philosophy of monism. Second figure came up. And then the third one, he said, to initiate one disciple with the name Parasara. I can't remember the exact detail of that. You remember the last? But he wanted to have one disciple whose name was Parasara, a glorification of Parasara Muni, who had written one very important scripture, which I can't remember now. So he wanted to honor Parasara Muni. Third finger came up. So like that, Ramanujacharya understood the mission of his guru, and he carried it out. Of course, this is the important part for devotees to understand, that the mission of the spiritual master is the life and soul of the devotee. One who makes the mission of the spiritual master their mood of devotional service becomes very dear to the spiritual master. We get special mercy and blessings if we, as Prabhupada said, do like I am doing. That means preach. It means preach. Everyone is meant to become a preacher in this movement. This is a preaching movement. There's two types of devotee, Ghosta Nandi and Bhajana Nandi. Bhajana Nandi is one who is satisfied with their own bhajan. And they cultivate devotional service, they make advancement like that, but they don't preach. And that's acceptable, but our mood of line, especially coming from Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta and Srila Prabhupada, is to spread Krishna consciousness worldwide. And that was Srila Prabhupada's intense desire to make this movement a worldwide movement. And he gave everything, every second of his time, to doing that. He would speak to many of his servants who, and secretaries who had into an association with Prabhupada. Prabhupada was intense. To be around Prabhupada means you have to be really, really serious. There was no nonsense with Prabhupada. And his intensity was that every minute he was thinking how to spread the Krishna consciousness at all times and all places. That was his mood. And he knew he only had so many years left, because he realized, 70 years old, beginning a movement. So he had that intense desire. And then he prayed to Krishna. Actually, he had a heart attack in 1967. He felt that this was the end. But he said, Krishna has given me some time. He's given me some more time to help spread this mission. So Krishna gave special concessions to Srila Prabhupada, extended his life so he could spread this mission around the world. And so that Prabhupada's mood was like that. He never wanted to stop that mood of preaching. So as explained, that one who makes the spiritual master's mission their life and soul also becomes very, very dear to the spiritual master, and special mercy and blessings. And one should not think preacher simply means giving class, or being sannyasi, or being in a male body. Preacher means that one somehow or other has to change the heart of another person towards Krishna. Whatever way you can bring another one closer to Krishna, through your words, through your actions, through your practical devotional service, whatever way you can do that, if you have that mood of service, then you are a preacher.
just fine. When we perform our service in such a way as to do it in a very nice way, that is preaching. When the deity is dressed very nicely, and the people come and see the beauty of the deity, that is preaching. That is the Pujari's way of preaching, by glorifying Krishna, by making him look so nice. That is preaching. So our mood would be that we're doing these things in order to attract others to Krishna consciousness. When somebody walks in the door, we say, Haribo, how are you? How are you today? Fine. Can we help you, serve you in any way? And that's preaching. You know, there's so many ways that we can preach, and we don't have to have great learning or erudition or any qualities, just a desire to preach. And if we do that as a service mood, and then we get the special mercy of Srila Prabhupada. So here, Jamunacharya, he had that mood. Jamunacharya attracted many followers of the disciples. History records the names of only 20 of them. Although they were sincere and devoted to their beloved Gurudev, none of them were blessed with the deep scholarship and determined energy required to carry out his work in a significant way. It was left to Sri Ramanujacharya to fulfill Jamunacharya's hopes for the future of Sri Vaishnavism. Periya Tirumalai Nambi was also called Sri Sayapurna. In some accounts, was Jamunacharya's favorite follower. Under the guidance of Jamunacharya, he accepted the renounced order of life and lived with his guru, serving him to the very end. Nabi had two sisters named Bhudevi and Sridevi. After the two consorts of Lord Vindakeshwar, Bhudevi married a pious Brahmin named Asuri Keshavacharya. Keshavacharya lived in Sri Pirmumbudura, about 26 miles from Madras. After some time, the child was born to them. He was named Lakshman by Nabi, after Lakshman, the brother of Sri Ramachandra. According to Sri Vaishnavism, Ramanuja was the incarnation of Lakshman himself. Since Lakshman had been a great devotee of Ram, the boy soon became known as Rama Anuja, the follower of Ram. According to Sri Vaishnava tradition, Ramanuja was born on the fifth day of the full moon in the month of Chaitra in 1017 AD. Ramanuja's family belonged to the caste of Vadama Smarta Brahmins, who were former Vedic scholars. Ramanuja's father, Keshavacharya, was very much attached to the performance of Vedic sacrifices, or yajnas. For this reason, he became known as